Disc 2.
Joanna had described him once as a plump pink cherub. He was still plump, but he was not looking like a cherub now. His face was a dark, congested purple, contorted with rage and surprise. And at that moment I realized that there had been something familiar about the look of that envelope. I had not realized it at the time. Indeed, it had been one of those things that you note unconsciously, without knowing that you do note them. "Goodness," said Joanna, "what's bitten the poor pet?" "I rather fancy," I said, "that it's the hidden hand again." She turned an astonished face towards me, and the car swerved. "Careful, wench," I said. Joanna refixed her attention on the road. She was frowning. "You mean a letter like the one you got?" "That's my guess." "What is this place?" asked Joanna. "It looks the most innocent, sleepy, harmless little bit of England you can imagine." "Where, to quote Mr. Pye, nothing ever happens," I cut in. He chose the wrong minute to say that. "Something has happened."
"But who writes these things, Jerry?"
I shrugged my shoulders. "My dear girl, how should I know? Some local nitwit with a screw loose, I suppose."
"But why? It seems so idiotic."
"You must read Freud and Jung and that lot to find out. Or ask our Dr. Owen." Joanna tossed her head.
"Dr. Owen doesn't like me."
"He's hardly seen you. He's seen quite enough, apparently, to make him cross over if he sees me coming along the high street." "A most unusual reaction," I said sympathetically. "And one you're not used to." Joanna was frowning again.
"No, but seriously, Jerry, why do people write anonymous letters?"
"As I say, they've got a screw loose. It satisfies some urge, I suppose. If you've been snubbed or ignored or frustrated, and your life's pretty drab and empty, I suppose you get a sense of power from stabbing in the dark at people who are happy and enjoying themselves." Joanna shivered.
"Not nice."
"No, not nice. I should imagine the people in these country places tend to be inbred, and so you would get a fair amount of queers. Somebody, I suppose, quite uneducated and inarticulate. With better education..." Joanna did not finish her sentence, and I said nothing. I have never been able to accept the easy belief that education is a panacea for every ill. As we drove through the town before climbing up the hill road, I looked curiously at the few figures abroad in the high street. Was one of those sturdy countrywomen going about with a load of spite and malice behind her placid brow, planning perhaps even now a further outpouring of vindictive spleen? But I still did not. 2 days later, we went to a bridge party at the Symingtons. It was a Saturday afternoon. The Symingtons always had their bridge parties on a Saturday, because the office was shut then. There were two tables. The players were the Symingtons, ourselves, Miss Griffith, Mr. Pye, Miss Barton, and a Colonel Appleton, whom we had not yet met, and who lived at Coomacre, a village some 7 miles distant. He was a perfect specimen of the blimp type, about 60 years of age, liked playing what he called a plucky game, which usually resulted in immense sums above the line being scored by his opponents, and was so intrigued by Joanna that he practically never took his eyes off her the whole afternoon. I was forced to admit that my sister was probably the most attractive thing that had been seen in Limstock for many a long day. When we arrived, Elsie Holland, the children's governess, was hunting for some extra bridge scorers in an ornate writing desk. She glided across the floor with them in the same celestial way I had first noticed, but the spell could not be cast a second time. Exasperating that it should be so, a waste of a perfectly lovely form and face. But I noticed now only too clearly the exceptionally large white teeth like tombstones, and the way she showed her gums when she laughed. She was, unfortunately, one of your prattling girls. "Are these the ones, Mrs. Symington? It's ever so stupid of me not to remember where we put them away last time. It's my fault, too, I'm afraid. I had them in my hand, and then Brian called out his engine had got caught, and I ran out, and what with one thing and another, I must have just stuffed them in somewhere stupid.
These aren't the right ones, I see now. They're a bit yellow at the edges. Shall I tell Agnes tea at 5? I'm taking the kiddies to Long Barrow, so there won't be any noise.
A nice, kind, bright girl. I caught Joanna's eye. She was laughing. I stared at her coldly. Joanna always knows what is passing in my mind. We settled down to bridge. I was soon to know to a nicety the bridge status of everyone in Limstock. Mrs. Symington was an exceedingly good bridge player and was quite a devotee of the game. Like many definitely unintellectual women, she was not stupid and had a considerable natural shrewdness. Her husband was a good sound player, slightly overcautious. Mr. Pye can best be described as brilliant. He had an uncanny flair for psychic bidding. Joanna and I, since the party was in our honour, played at a table with Mrs. Symington and Mr. Pye. It was Symington's task to pour oil on troubled waters, and by the exercise of tact to reconcile the 3 other players at his table. Colonel Appleton, as I have said, was wont to play a plucky game. Little Miss Barton was without exception the worst bridge player I have ever come across, and always enjoyed herself enormously. She did manage to follow suit, but had the wildest ideas as to the strength of her hand, never knew the score, repeatedly led out of the wrong hand, and was quite unable to count trumps, and often forgot what they were. Amy Griffith's play can be summed up in her own words. "I like a good game of bridge with no nonsense, and I don't play any of these rubbishy conventions. I say what I mean, and no post-mortems. After all, it's only a game." It will be seen, therefore, that their host had not too easy a task. Play proceeded fairly harmoniously, however, with occasional forgetfulness on the part of Colonel Appleton as he stared across at Joanna. Tea was laid in the dining room, round a big table. As we were finishing, 2 hot and excited little boys rushed in and were introduced, Mrs. Symington beaming with maternal pride, as was their father. Then, just as we were finishing, a shadow darkened my plate, and I turned my head to see Megan standing in the French window.
"Oh," said her mother, "here's Megan." Her voice held a faintly surprised note, as though she had forgotten that Megan existed. The girl came in and shook hands awkwardly and without any grace.
"I'm afraid I forgot about your tea, dear," said Mrs. Symington. "Miss Holland and the boys took theirs out with them, so there's no nursery tea today. I forgot you weren't with them." Megan nodded. "That's all right. I'll go to the kitchen."
She slouched out of the room. She was untidily dressed as usual, and there were potatoes in both heels. Mrs. Symington said with a little apologetic laugh, "My poor Megan. She's just at that awkward age, you know. Girls are always shy and awkward when they've just left school before they're properly grown up." I saw Joanna's fair head jerk backwards in what I knew to be a warlike gesture. "But Megan's 20, isn't she?" she said.
"Oh, yes, yes, she is. But of course she's very young for her age, quite a child still. It's so nice, I think, when girls don't grow up too quickly."
She laughed again.
"I expect all mothers want their children to remain babies."
"Can't think why," said Joanna. "After all, it would be a bit awkward if one had a child who remained mentally 6 while his body grew up."
"Oh, you mustn't take things so literally, Miss Burton."
It occurred to me at that moment that I did not much care for Mrs. Symington. That anemic, slighted, faded prettiness concealed, I thought, a selfish and grasping nature. She said, and I disliked her a little more still,
"My poor Megan. She's rather a difficult child, I'm afraid. I've been trying to find something for her to do. I believe there are several things one can learn by correspondence. Designing and dressmaking. Or she might try and learn shorthand and typing."
The red glint was still in Joanna's eye. She said as we sat down again at the bridge table, "I suppose she'll be going to parties and all that sort of thing. Are you going to give a dance for her?"
"A dance?"
Mrs. Symington seemed surprised and amused.
"Oh, no. We don't do things like that down here."
"I see. Just tennis parties and things like that."
"Our tennis court has not been played on for years. Neither Richard nor I play.
I suppose later, when the boys grow up. Oh, Megan will find plenty to do. She's quite happy just pottering about, you know. Let me see. Did I deal? 2 no-trumps. As we drove home, Joanna said, with a vicious pressure on the accelerator pedal that made the car leap forward, I feel awfully sorry for that girl. Megan?
Yes. Her mother doesn't like her.
Oh, come now, Joanna. It's not as bad as that.
Yes, it is. Lots of mothers don't like their children. Megan, I should imagine, is an awkward sort of creature to have about the house. She disturbs the pattern. The Symington pattern. It's a complete unit without her. And that's a most unhappy feeling for a sensitive creature to have. And she is sensitive.
Yes, I said. I think she is.
I was silent a moment. Joanna suddenly laughed mischievously.
Bad luck for you about the governess.
I don't know what you mean, I said with dignity.
Nonsense. Masculine chagrin was written on your face every time you looked at her.
I agree with you.
It is a waste.
I don't know what you're talking about.
But I'm delighted all the same. It's the first sign of reviving life.
I was quite worried about you at the nursing home. You never even looked at that remarkably pretty nurse you had. An attractive minx, too. Absolutely God's gift to a sick man.
Your conversation, Joanna, I find definitely low.
My sister continued without paying.
So I was much relieved to see you've still got an eye for a nice bit of skirt.
She is a good looker.
Funny that the S.A. should have been left out completely. Tis odd, you know, Jerry. What is the thing that some women have and others haven't? What is it makes one woman, even if she only says foul weather, so attractive that every man within range wants to come over and talk about the weather with her? I suppose Providence makes a mistake every now and then when sending out the parcel. One Aphrodite face and form, one temperament ditto. And something goes astray, and the Aphrodite temperament goes to some little plain-faced creature, and then all the other women go simply mad and say, I can't think what the men see in her. She isn't even good-looking.
Have you quite finished, Joanna?
Well, you do agree, don't you?
I grinned.
I'll admit to disappointment. And I don't see who else there is here for you. You'll have to fall back upon Amy Griffith.
God forbid, I said.
She's quite good-looking, you know.
Too much of an Amazon for me.
She seems to enjoy her life, all right, said Joanna.
Absolutely disgustingly hearty, isn't she?
I shouldn't be at all surprised if she had a cold bath every morning.
And what are you going to do for yourself, I asked.
Me?
Yes.
You'll need a little distraction down here, if I know you.
Who's being low now?
Besides, you forget Paul.
Joanna heaved up a not very convincing sigh. I shan't forget him nearly as quickly as you will. In about 10 days you'll be saying, Paul?
Paul who?
I never knew a Paul.
You think I'm completely fickle, said Joanna.
When people like Paul are in question, I'm only too glad that you should be.
You never did like him, but he really was a bit of a genius.
Possibly, though I doubt it. Anyway, from all I've heard, geniuses are people to be heartily disliked.
One thing, you won't find any geniuses down here.
Joanna considered for a moment, her head on one side.
I'm afraid not, she said regretfully.
You'll have to fall back upon Owen Griffith, I said. He's the only unattached male in the place.
Unless you count old Colonel Appleton. He was looking at you like a hungry bloodhound most of the afternoon.
Joanna laughed.
He was, wasn't he? It was quite embarrassing.
Don't pretend. You're never embarrassed. Joanna drove in silence through the gate and round to the garage. She said then,
There may be something in that idea of yours.
What idea?
Joanna replied, I don't see why any man should deliberately cross the street to avoid me. It's rude, apart from anything else.
I see, I said.
You're going to hunt the man down in cold blood. Well, I don't like being avoided.
I got slowly and carefully out of the car and balanced my sticks. Then I offered my sister a piece of advice. Let me tell you this, my girl. Owen Griffith isn't any of your tame, whining, artistic young men. Unless you're careful, you'll stir up a hornet's nest about your ears. That man could be dangerous.
Oh, do you think so?
Demanded Joanna, with every symptom of pleasure at the prospect. Leave the poor devil alone, I said sternly.
How dare he cross the street when he saw me coming? All you women are alike. You harp on one theme. You'll have Sister Amy gunning you too, if I'm not mistaken.
She dislikes me already, said Joanna.
She spoke meditatively, but with a certain satisfaction. We have come down here, I said sternly, for peace and quiet, and I mean to see we get it. But peace and quiet were the last things we were to have. Chapter 4 It was, I think, about a week later that Partridge informed me that Mrs. Baker would like to speak to me for a minute or two if I would be so kind. The name Mrs. Baker conveyed nothing at all to me.
"Who is Mrs. Baker?" I said, bewildered.
"Can't she see Miss Joanna?" But it appeared that I was the person with whom an interview was desired. It further transpired that Mrs. Baker was the mother of the girl Beatrice. I had forgotten Beatrice. For a fortnight now I had been conscious of a middle-aged woman with wisps of grey hair, usually on her knees retreating crab-like from bathroom and stairs and passages when I appeared, and I knew, I suppose, that she was our new daily woman. Otherwise the Beatrice complication had faded from my mind. I could not very well refuse to see Beatrice's mother, especially as I learned that Joanna was out, but I was, I must confess, a little nervous at the prospect. I sincerely hoped that I was not going to be accused of having trifled with Beatrice's affections. I cursed the mischievous activities of anonymous letter-writers to myself, at the same time as aloud I commanded that Beatrice's mother should be brought to my presence. Mrs. Baker was a big, broad, weather-beaten woman, with a rapid flow of speech. I was relieved to notice no signs of anger or accusation. "I hope, sir," she said, beginning at once when the door had closed behind Partridge, "that you'll excuse the liberty I've taken in coming to see you. But I thought, sir, as you was the proper person to come to, and I should be thankful if you could see your way to telling me what I ought to do in the circumstances, because, in my opinion, sir, something ought to be done, and I've never been one to let the grass grow under my feet, and what I say is, no use moaning and groaning, but up and doing, as Vicar said in his sermon only the week before last." I felt slightly bewildered, and as though I had missed something essential in the conversation.
"Certainly," I said. "Won't you sit down, Mrs. Baker? I'm sure I shall be glad to help you in any way I can."
I paused expectantly. "Thank you, sir." Mrs. Baker...
"It's very good of you, I'm sure. And glad I am that I came to you," I said to Beatrice, I said, "and her howling and crying on her bed. Mr. Burton will know what to do," I said, "being a London gentleman. And something must be done, what with young men being so hot-headed and not listening to reason the way they are, and not listening to a word a girl says, and anyway, if it was me," I says to Beatrice, "I'd give him as good as I got. And what about that girl down at the mill?"
I felt more than ever bewildered.
"I'm sorry," I said, "but I don't quite understand. What has happened?" "It's the letters, sir. Wicked letters. Indecent, too, using such words and all. Worse than I've ever seen in the Bible, even."
Passing over an interesting sideline here, I said desperately,
"Has your daughter been having more letters?" "Not her, sir. She had just the one. That one as was the occasion of her leaving here."
"There was absolutely no reason," I began, but Mrs. Baker firmly and respectfully interrupted me.
"There is no need to tell me, sir, that what was wrote was all wicked lies. I had Miss Partridge's word for that, and indeed I would have known it for myself. You aren't that type of gentleman, sir, that I well know, and you an invalid and all. Wicked, untruthful lies it was. But all the same, my sister Beatrice says she'd better leave, because you know what talk is, sir. No smoke without fire, that's what people say. And a girl can't be too careful, and besides, the girl herself felt bashful-like after what had been written, so I says quite right to Beatrice when she says she wouldn't come up here again, though I'm sure we both regretted the inconvenience being such."
Unable to find her way out of this sentence, Mrs. Baker took a deep breath and began again.
"And that, I hoped, would be the end of any nasty talk. But now George, down at the garage, in what Beatrice is going with, he's got one of them. saying awful things about her, Beatrice, and how she's going on with Fred Ledbetter's Tom. And I can assure you, sir, the girl has been no more than civil to him, and passing the time of day, so to speak. My head was now reeling under this new complication of Mr. Ledbetter's Tom. Let me get this straight, I said. Beatrice's, young man has had an anonymous letter making accusations about her and another young man. That's right, sir. And not nicely put at all. Horrible words used, and it drove young George mad with rage, it did. And he come round and told Beatrice he wasn't going to put up with that sort of thing from her, and he wasn't going to have her go behind his back with other chaps. And she says it's all a lie, and he says, no smoke without fire, he says, and rushes off being hot-like in his temper. And Beatrice, she took on ever so, poor girl, and I said I'll put my hat on and come. Mrs. Baker paused and looked at me expectantly, like a dog waiting for reward after doing a particularly clever trick. "But why come to me?" I demanded. "I understood, sir, that you'd had one of these nasty letters yourself, and I thought, sir, that being a London gentleman, you'd know what to do about them." "If I were you," I said, "I should go to the police. This sort of thing ought to be stopped." Mrs. Baker looked deeply shocked. "Oh, no, sir. I couldn't go to the police."
"Why not?"
"I've never been mixed up with the police, sir." "None of us ever have."
"Probably not, but the police are the only people who can deal with this sort of thing. It's their business."
"Go to Bert Rundle?"
Bert Rundle was the constable I knew.
"There's a sergeant or an inspector, surely, at the police station?" "Me? Go into the police station?"
Mrs. Baker's voice expressed reproach and incredulity. I began to feel annoyed. "That's the only advice I can give you." Mrs. Baker was silent, obviously quite unconvinced. She said wistfully and earnestly,
"These letters ought to be stopped, sir. They did ought to be stopped. There'll be mischief done sooner or later."
"It seems to me there is mischief done now," I said.
"I meant violence, sir. These young fellows, they get violent in their feelings. And so do the older ones."
I asked, "Are a good many of these letters going about?" Mrs. Baker nodded.
"It's getting worse and worse, sir. Mr. and Mrs. Beadle at the Blue Boar. Very happy they've always been. And now these letters comes and it sets him thinking things. Things that aren't so, sir."
I leaned forward. "Mrs. Baker," I said, "have you any idea at all, who is writing these abominable letters?" To my great surprise, she nodded her head.
"We've got our idea, sir. Yes, we've all got a very fair idea."
"Who is it?" I had fancied that she might be reluctant to mention a name, but she replied promptly,
"'Tis Mrs. Cleet. That's what we all think, sir. 'Tis Mrs. Cleet, for sure."
I had heard so many names this morning that I was quite bewildered. I asked, "Who is Mrs. Cleet?" Mrs. Cleet, I discovered, was the wife of an elderly jobbing gardener. She lived in a cottage on the road leading down to the mill. My further questions only brought unsatisfactory answers. Questioned as to why Mrs. Cleet should write these letters, Mrs. Baker would only say vaguely that 'twould be like her. In the end, I let her go, reiterating once more my advice to go to the police, advice which I could see Mrs. Baker was not going to act upon. I was left with the impression that I had disappointed her. I thought over what she had said. Vague as the evidence was, I decided that if the village was all agreed that Mrs. Cleet was the culprit, then it was probably true. I decided to go and consult Griffith about the whole thing. Presumably, he would know this Cleet woman. If he thought advisable, he or I might suggest to the police that she was at the bottom of this growing annoyance. I timed my arrival for about the moment I fancied Griffith would have finished his surgery. When the last patient had left, I... "Hello, it's you, Burton." I outlined my conversation with Mrs. Baker and passed on to him the conviction that this Mrs. Cleet was responsible. Rather to my disappointment, Griffith shook his head. "It's not so simple as that," he said. "You don't think this Cleet woman is at the bottom of it?" "She may be, but I should think it most unlikely." "Then why do they all think it is her?" He smiled. "Oh," he said, "you don't understand. Mrs. Cleet is the local witch." "Good gracious," I exclaimed. "Yes, sounds rather strange nowadays. Nevertheless, that's what it amounts to. The feeling lingers, you know, that there are certain people, certain families, for instance, whom it isn't wise to offend. Mrs. Cleet came from a family of wise women, and I'm afraid she's taken pains to cultivate the legend. She's a queer woman with a bitter and sardonic sense of humour. It's been easy enough for her, if a child cuts its finger or had a bad fall or sickened with mumps, to nod her head and say, "Yes, he stole my apples last week," or "He pulled my cat's tail." Soon enough, mothers pulled their children away, and other women brought honey or a cake they'd baked to give to Mrs. Cleet, so as to keep on the right side of her, so that she shouldn't ill-wish them. It's superstitious and silly, but it happens. So, naturally, now they think she's at the bottom of this. But she isn't. Oh, no, she isn't the type. It's not so simple as that. Have you any idea? I looked at him curiously. He shook his head, but his eyes were absent. No, he said. I don't know at all. But I don't like it, Burton. Some harm is going to come of this. When I got back to the house, I found Megan sitting on the veranda steps, her chin resting on her knees. She greeted me with her usual lack of ceremony. Hello, she said. Do you think I could come to lunch? Certainly, I said. If it's chops or anything difficult like that and they won't go round, just tell me, shouted Megan as I went round to apprise Partridge of the fact that there would be three to lunch. I fancy that Partridge sniffed. She certainly managed to convey without saying a word of any kind that she didn't think much of that Miss Megan. I went back to the veranda. Is it quite all right? Asked Megan anxiously. Quite all right, I said. Irish stew. Oh, well, that's rather like dog's dinner anyway, isn't it? I mean, it's mostly potato and flavour. I took out my cigarette case and offered it to Megan. She flushed. How nice of you. Won't you have one? No, I don't think I will, but it was very nice of you to offer it to me. Just as though I was a real person. Aren't you a real person? I said, amused. Megan shook her head. Then, changing the subject, she stretched out a long, dusty leg for my inspection. I've darned my stockings, she announced proudly. I am not an authority on darning, but it did occur to me that the strange, puckered blot of violently contrasting wool was perhaps not quite a success. It's much more uncomfortable than the hole, said Megan. It looks as though it might be, I agreed. Does your sister darn well? I tried to think if I had ever observed any of Joanna's handiwork in this direction. I don't know, I had to confess. Well, what does she do when she gets a hole in her stocking? I rather think, I said reluctantly, that she throws them away and buys another pair. Very sensible, said Megan, but I can't do that. I get an allowance now, £40 a year. You can't do much on that. I agreed. If only I wore black stockings, I could ink my legs, said Megan sadly. That's what I always did at school. Miss Batworthy, the mistress who looked after our mending, was like her name, blind as a bat. It was awfully useful. It must have been, I said. We were silent while I smoked my pipe. It was quite a companionable silence. Megan broke it by saying suddenly and violently, I suppose you think I'm awful, like everyone else. I was so startled that my pipe fell out of my mouth. It was a meerschaum, just colouring nicely, and it broke. I said angrily to Megan, Now see what you've done. That most unaccountable of children, instead of being upset, merely grinned broadly. I do like you, she said. It was a most warming remark. It is the remark that one fancies, perhaps erroneously, that one's dog would say if he could talk. It occurred to me that Megan, for all she looked like a horse, had the disposition of a dog. She was certainly not quite human. What did you say before the catastrophe? I asked, carefully picking up the fragments of my cherished pipe. I said I supposed you thought me awful, said Megan, but not at all in the same tone she had said it before. Why should I? Megan said gravely. Because I am, I said sharply. Don't be stupid. Megan shook her head. That's just it. I'm not really stupid. People think I am. They don't know that inside I know
just what they're like, and that all the time I'm hating them.
Hating them?
Yes, said Megan.
Her eyes, those melancholy, unchildlike eyes, stared straight into mine without blinking. It was a long, mournful gaze.
You would hate people if you were like me, she said.
Don't you think you're being rather morbid, I asked.
Yes, said Megan.
That's what people always say when you're saying the truth.
And it is true. I'm not wanted, and I can quite see why. Mummy doesn't like me a bit. I remind her, I think, of my father, who was cruel to her, and pretty dreadful, from all I can hear. Only mothers can't say they don't want their children and just go away. Or eat them. Cats eat the kittens they don't like. Awfully sensible, I think, no waste or mess. But human mothers have to keep their children and look after them. It hasn't been so bad while I could be sent away to school. But you see, what Mummy would really like is to be just herself and my stepfather and the boys. I said slowly,
I still think you're morbid, Megan. But accepting some of what you say as true, why don't you go away and have a life of your own? She gave me an unchildlike smile.
You mean take up a career? Earn my living?
Yes.
What at?
You could train for something, I suppose. Shorthand typing, bookkeeping.
I don't believe I could. I'm stupid about doing things. And besides...
Well?
She had turned her face away. Now she turned it slowly back again. It was crimson, and there were tears in her eyes. She spoke now with all the childishness back in her voice. Why should I go away? And be made to go away? They don't want me, but I'll stay. I'll stay and make everyone sorry. I'll make them all sorry. Hateful pigs. I hate everyone here in Limstock. They all think I'm stupid and ugly. I'll show them. I'll show them, I'll...
It was a childish, oddly pathetic rage. I heard a step on the gravel round the corner of the house.
Get up, I said savagely.
Go into the house through the drawing room. Go up to the first floor to the bathroom, end of the passage. Wash your face. Quick!
She sprang awkwardly to her feet and darted through the window as Joanna came round the corner of the house. Gosh, I'm hot! She called out.
She sat down beside me and fanned her face with the Tyrolean scarf that had been round her head.
Still, I think I'm educating these damn brogues now. I've walked miles.
I've learnt one thing. You shouldn't have these fancy holes in your brogues. The gorse prickles go through.
Do you know, Jerry, I think we ought to have a dog.
And so do I said.
By the way, Megan is coming to lunch.
Is she?
Good.
You like her? I asked.
I think she's a changeling, said Joanna. Something left on a doorstep, you know, while the fairies take the right one away.
It's very interesting to meet a changeling.
Oh, I must go up and wash.
You can't yet, I said. Megan is washing.
Oh, she's been foot-slogging too, has she?
Joanna took out her mirror and looked at her face long and earnestly.
I don't think I like this lipstick, she announced presently.
Megan came out through the window. She was composed, moderately clean, and showed no signs of the recent storm. She looked doubtfully at Joanna.
Hello, said Joanna, still preoccupied by her face. I'm so glad you've come to lunch.
Good gracious, I've got a freckle on my nose. I must do something about it. Freckles are so earnest and Scottish. Partridge came out and said coldly that luncheon was served.
Come on, said Joanna, getting up. I'm starving.
She put her arm through Megan's, and they went into the house together. Chapter 5. I see that there has been one omission in my story. So far I have made little or no mention of Mrs. Dane Calthrop, or indeed, of the Reverend Caleb Dane Calthrop. And yet both the vicar and his wife were distinct personalities. Dane Calthrop himself was perhaps a being more remote from everyday life than anyone I have ever met. His existence was in his books and in his study, and in his intimate knowledge of early church history. Mrs. Dane Calthrop, on the other hand, was quite terrifyingly on the spot. I have perhaps purposely put off mentioning her, because I was from the first a little afraid of her. She was a woman of character and of almost Olympian knowledge. She was not in the least the typical vicar's wife. But that, as I set it down, makes me ask myself, what do I know of vicar's wives? The only one I remember well was a quiet, nondescript creature, devoted to a big, strong husband with a magnetic way of preaching. She had so little general conversation that it was a puzzle to know how to sustain a conversation with her. Otherwise, I was depending on the fictional presentment of vicar's wives, caricatures of females poking their noses everywhere and uttering platitudes. Probably no such type exists. Mrs. Dane Calthrop never poked her nose in anywhere. Yet she had an uncanny power of knowing things, and I soon discovered that almost everyone in the village was slightly afraid of her. She gave no advice and never interfered, yet she represented to any uneasy conscience the deity personified. I have never seen a woman more indifferent to her material surroundings. On hot days she would stride about clad in Harris tweed, and in rain or even sleet I have seen her absent-mindedly race down the village street in a cotton dress of printed poppies. She had a long, thin, well-bred face like a greyhound, and a most devastating... She stopped me in the high street the day after Megan had come to lunch. I had the usual feeling of surprise, because Mrs. Dane Calthrop's progress resembled coursing more than walking, and her eyes were always fixed on the distant horizon, so that you felt sure her real objective was about a mile and a half away. "Oh," she said, "Mr. Burton!" She said it rather triumphantly. Someone might who had solved a particularly clever puzzle. I admitted that I was Mr. Burton, and Mrs. Dane Calthrop stopped focusing on the horizon and seemed to be trying to focus on me instead. "Now what," she said, "did I want to see you about?" I could not help her there. She stood frowning, deeply perplexed. "Something rather nasty," she said. "I'm sorry about that," I said, startled. "Ah!" cried Mrs. Dane Calthrop. "I hate my love with an A!" "That's it. Anonymous letters. What's this story you've brought down here about anonymous letters?" "I didn't bring it," I said. "It was here already." "Nobody got any until you came, though," said Mrs. Dane Calthrop accusingly. "But they did," Mrs. Dane Calthrop. "The trouble had already started." "Oh, dear," said Mrs. Dane Calthrop. "I don't like that." She stood there, her eyes absent and far away again. She said, "I can't help feeling it's all wrong. We're not like that here. Envy, of course, and malice, and all the mean, spiteful little sins. But I didn't think there was anyone who would do that. No, I really didn't. And it distresses me, you see, because I ought to know." Her fine eyes came back from the horizon and met mine. They were worried and seemed to hold the honest bewilderment of a child. "How should you know?" I said. "I usually do. I've always felt that's my function. Caleb preaches good sound doctrine and administers the sacraments. That's a priest's duty. But if you admit marriage at all for a priest, then I think his wife's duty is to know what people are feeling and thinking, even if she can't do anything about it. And I haven't the least idea whose mind is..." She broke off, adding absently, "They are such silly letters, too. Have you, had any yourself?" I was a little diffident of asking, but Mrs. Dane Calthrop replied perfectly naturally, her eyes opening a little wider. "Oh, yes, two. No, three. I forget exactly what they said, something very silly about Caleb and the schoolmistress, I think. Quite absurd, because Caleb has absolutely no taste for fornication. He never has had. So lucky, being a clergyman." "Quite," I said. "Oh, quite. Caleb would have been a saint," said Mrs. Dane Calthrop, "if he hadn't been just a little..." I did not feel qualified to answer this criticism. And anyway, Mrs. Dane Calthrop went on, leaping back from her husband to the letters in rather a puzzling way. "There are so many things the letters might say but don't. That's what is so curious." "I should hardly have thought they erred on the side of restraint," I said bitterly. "But they don't seem to know anything. None of the real things." "You mean..." Those fine, vague eyes met mine. Well, of course. There's plenty of adultery here, and everything else. Any amount of shameful secrets. Why doesn't the writer use those? She paused, and then asked abruptly, "What did they say in your letter?" "They suggested that my sister wasn't my sister."
"And she is?"
Mrs. Dane Calthrop asked the question with unembarrassed friendly interest. "Certainly Joanna is my sister." Mrs. Dane Calthrop nodded her head. "That just shows you what I mean. I dare say there are other things." Her clear, uninterested eyes looked at me thoughtfully, and I suddenly understood why Limstock was afraid of Mrs. Dane Calthrop. In everybody's life, there are hidden chapters which they hope may never be known. I felt that Mrs. Dane Calthrop knew them. For once in my life, I was positively delighted when Amy Griffith's hearty voice boomed out, "Hello, Maud! Glad I've just caught you. I want to suggest an alteration of date for the sale of work. Morning, Mr. Burton," she went on. "I must just pop into the grocer's and leave my order. Then I'll come along to the Institute if that suits you."
"Yes, yes, that will do quite well," said Mrs. Dane Calthrop.
Amy Griffith went into the International Stores. Mrs. Dane Calthrop said, "Poor thing." I was puzzled. Surely she could not be pitying Amy. She went on, however, "You know, Mr. Burton, I'm rather afraid about this letter business."
"Yes, you see, it means... it must mean..."
She paused, lost in thought, her eyes screwed up. Then she said slowly, as one who solves a problem, "Blind hatred. Yes, blind hatred. But even a blind man might stab to the heart by pure chance." "And what would happen then, Mr. Burton?" We were to know that before another day. It was Partridge who brought the news of the tragedy. Partridge enjoys calamity. Her nose always twitches ecstatically when she has to break bad news of any kind. She came into Joanna's room with her nose working overtime, her eyes bright, and her mouth pulled down into an exaggerated gloom. "There's terrible news this morning, miss," she observed as she drew up the blinds. "It takes a minute or two for Joanna with her London habits to become fully conscious in the morning," she said, and rolled over without any real interest. Partridge placed her early tea beside her and began again.
"Terrible it is. Shocking. I couldn't hardly believe it when I heard."
"What's terrible?" said Joanna, struggling into wakefulness.
"Poor Mrs. Symington."
She paused dramatically.
"Dead."
"Dead?" Joanna sat up in bed, now wide awake.
"Yes, miss. Yesterday afternoon. And what's worse, took her own life."
"Oh, no, Partridge." Joanna was really shocked. Mrs. Symington was not somehow the sort of person you associated with tragedies.
"Yes, miss, it's the truth. Did it deliberate. Not but what she was drove to it, poor soul."
"Drove to it?" Joanna had an inkling of the truth then. "Not." Her eyes questioned Partridge, and Partridge nodded.
"That's right, miss. One of them nasty letters."
"What did it say?" But that, to Partridge's regret, she had not succeeded in learning.
"They're beastly things," said Joanna. "But I don't see why they should make one want to kill oneself."
Partridge sniffed, and then said with meaning,
"Not unless they were true, miss."
"Oh," said Joanna. She drank her tea after Partridge had left the room. Then she threw on a dressing gown and came in to me to tell me the news. I thought of what Owen Griffith had said. Sooner or later, the shot in the dark went home. It had done with Mrs. Symington. She, apparently the most unlikely of women, had had a secret. It was true, I reflected, that for all her shrewdness, she was not a woman of much stamina. She was the anemic, clinging type that crumples easily. Joanna nudged me and asked me what I was thinking about. I repeated to her what Owen had said. "Of course," said Joanna waspishly. "He would know all about it.
That man thinks he knows everything."
"He's clever," I said.
"He's conceited," said Joanna.
She added,
"Abominably conceited."
After a minute or two, she said, "How awful for her husband, and for the girl. What do you think Megan will feel about it?" I hadn't the slightest idea and said so. It was curious that one could never gauge what Megan would think or feel. Joanna nodded and said, "No, one never does know with changelings." After a minute or two, she said, "Do you think... would you like... I wonder if she'd like to come and stay with us for a day or two. It's rather a shock for a girl that age." "We might go along and suggest..." "The children are all right," said Joanna. "They've got that governess woman. But I expect she's just the sort of creature that would drive someone like Megan mad." I thought that was very possible. I could imagine Elsie Holland uttering platitude after platitude and suggesting innumerable cups of tea. A kindly creature, but not, I thought, the person for a sensitive girl. I had thought myself of bringing Megan away, and I was glad that Joanna had thought of it spontaneously, without prompting from me. We went down to the Symington's house after breakfast. We were a little nervous, both of us. Our arrival might look like sheer ghoulish curiosity. Luckily, we met Owen Griffith just coming out through the gate. He looked worried and preoccupied. He greeted me, however, with some warmth. "Oh, hello, Burton. I'm glad to see you. What I was afraid would happen sooner or later has happened. Damnable business." "Dr. Griffith," said Joanna, using the voice she keeps for one of our deafer aunts. Griffith started and flushed. Oh, good morning, Miss Burton." "I thought perhaps," said Joanna, "that you didn't see me." Owen Griffith got redder still. His shyness enveloped him like a mantle. I'm so sorry. Preoccupied. I didn't." Joanna went on mercilessly. "After all, I am life-size." "Merely Kit-Kat," I said in a stern aside to her. Then I went on. "My sister and I, Griffith, wondered whether it would be a good thing if the girl came and stopped with us for a day or two. What do you think? I don't want to butt in, but it must be rather grim for the poor child. What would Symington feel about it, do you think?" Griffith turned the idea over in his mind for a moment or two. "I think it would be an excellent thing," he said at last. "She's a queer, nervy sort of girl, and it would be good for her to get away from the whole thing. Miss Holland is doing wonders. She's an excellent head on her shoulders, but she really has quite enough to do with the two children and Symington himself. He's quite broken up. Bewildered." "It was..." I hesitated. "Suicide?" Griffith nodded. "Oh, yes. No question of accident. She wrote, 'I can't go on a scrap of paper. The letter must have come by yesterday afternoon's post. The envelope was down on the floor by her chair, and the letter itself was screwed up into a ball and thrown into the fireplace." "What did—" I stopped, rather horrified at myself. "I beg your pardon," I said. Griffith gave a quick, unhappy smile. "You needn't mind asking. That letter will have to be read at the inquest. No getting out of it, more's the pity. It was the usual kind of thing, couched in the same foul style. The specific accusation was that the second boy, Colin, was not Symington's child." "Do you think that was true?" I exclaimed incredulously. Griffith shrugged his shoulders. "I've no means of forming a judgment. I've only been here for 5 years. As far as I've ever seen, the Symingtons were a placid, happy couple, devoted... It's true that the boy doesn't particularly resemble his parents. He's got bright red hair, for one thing. But a child often throws back in appearance to a grandfather or grandmother. That lack of resemblance might have been what prompted the particular accusation. A foul and quite uncalled-for bow at a venture. Very likely. In fact, probably. There's not been much accurate knowledge behind these poisoned pen letters. Just unbridled spite and malice. But it happened to hit the bull's-eye," said Joanna. "After all, she wouldn't have killed herself otherwise, would she?" Griffith said doubtfully, "I'm not quite sure. She's been ailing in health for some time. Neurotic, hysterical. I've been treating her for a nervous condition. It's possible, I think, that the shock of receiving such a letter, couched in those terms, may have induced such a state of panic and despondency that she may have decided to take her life. She may have worked herself up to feel that her husband might not believe her if she denied the story, and the general shame and disgust might have worked upon her so powerfully as to temporarily unbalance her judgment. "Suicide whilst of unsound mind," said Joanna. "Exactly. I shall be quite justified, I think, in putting forward that point of view at the inquest."
"I see."
There was something in her voice which made Owen say, "Perfectly justified," in an angry voice. He added, "You don't agree, Miss Burton?"
"Oh, yes, I do," said Joanna.
"I'd do exactly the same in your place." Owen looked at her doubtfully, then moved slowly away down the street. Joanna and I went on into the house. The front door was open, and it seemed easier than ringing the bell, especially as we had heard Elsie Holland's voice inside. She was talking to Mr. Symington, who, huddled in a chair, was looking completely dazed.
"No, but really, Mr. Symington, you must take something. You haven't had any breakfast, not what I call a proper breakfast, and nothing to eat last night. And what with the shock and all, you'll be getting ill yourself, and you'll need all your strength. The doctor said so before he left."
Symington said in a toneless voice, "You're very kind, Miss Holland, but..." "A nice cup of hot tea," said Elsie Holland, thrusting the beverage on him firmly. "Personally, I should have given the poor devil a stiff whiskey and soda." He looked as though he needed it. However, he accepted the tea and, looking up at Elsie Holland,
"I can't thank you for all you've done and are doing, Miss Holland. You've been perfectly splendid."
The girl flushed and looked pleased.
"Nice of you to say that, Mr. Symington. You must let me do all I can to help. Don't worry about the children. I'll see to them, and I've got the servants calmed down, and if there's anything I can do, letter writing or telephoning, don't hesitate to ask me."
"You're very kind," Symington said again.
Elsie Holland, turning, caught sight of us and came hurrying out into the hall. "Isn't it terrible?" she said in a hushed whisper. I thought as I looked at her that she was really a very nice girl. Kind, competent, practical in an emergency. Her magnificent blue eyes were just faintly rimmed with pink, showing that she had been soft-hearted enough to shed tears for her employer's death.
"Can we speak to you a minute?" asked Joanna.
"We don't want to disturb Mr. Symington."
Elsie Holland nodded comprehendingly and led the way into the dining room on the other side of the hall.
"It's been awful for him," she said. "Such a shock. Whoever would have thought a thing like this could happen? But, of course, I do realise now that she had been queer for some time. Awfully nervy and weepy. I thought it was her health, though Dr. Griffith always said there was nothing really wrong with her. But she was snappy and irritable, and some days you just wouldn't know how to take her."
"What we really came for," said Joanna, "was to know whether we could have Megan for a few days. That is, if she'd like to come." Elsie Holland looked rather surprised.
"Megan," she said doubtfully. "I don't know, I'm sure. I mean, it's ever so kind of you, but she's such a queer girl. One never knows what she's going to say or feel about things."
Joanna said rather vaguely,
"We thought it might be a help, perhaps."
"Oh, well, as far as that goes, it would. I mean, I've got the boys to look after. They're with Cook just now. And poor Mr. Symington, he really needs looking after as much as anyone. And such a lot to do and see to. I really haven't had time to see much to Megan. I think she's upstairs in the old nursery at the top of the house. She seems to want to get away from everyone. I don't know if..."
I slipped quickly out of the room and upstairs. The old nursery was at the top of the house. I opened the door and went in. The room downstairs had given onto the garden behind, and the blinds had not been down there. But in this room, which faced the road, they were decorously drawn down. Through a dim grey gloom, I saw Megan. She was crouching on a divan set against the far wall, and I was reminded at once of some terrified animal hiding. She looked petrified with fear. "Megan," I said. I came forward and, unconsciously, I adopted the tone one does adopt when you want to reassure a frightened animal. I'm really surprised I didn't hold out a carrot or a piece of sugar. I felt like that. She stared at me, but she did not move, and her expression did not alter.
"Megan," I said again. Joanna and I have come to ask you if you would like to come and stay with us for a little. Her voice came hollowly out of the dim twilight.
Stay with you? In your house?
Yes.
You mean you'll take me away from here?
Yes, my dear. Suddenly she began to shake all over. It was frightening and very moving.
Oh, do take me away, please do. It's so awful being here and feeling so wicked.
I came over to her, and her hands fastened on my coat sleeve.
I'm an awful coward. I didn't know what a coward I was.
It's all right, funny face, I said. These things are a bit shattering. Come along.
Can we go at once, without waiting a minute?
Well, you'll have to put a few things together, I suppose.
What sort of things? Why?
My dear girl, I said, we can provide you with a bed and a bath and the rest of it, but I'm damned if I lend you my toothbrush. She gave a very faint, weak little laugh.
I see. I think I'm stupid today. You mustn't mind. I'll go and pack some things. You won't go away. You'll wait for me.
I'll be on the mat.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm sorry I'm so stupid, but you see, it's rather dreadful when your mother dies.
I know, I said. I gave her a friendly pat on the back, and she flashed me a grateful look and disappeared into a bedroom. I went on downstairs.
End of disc 2.